The same on his card. Now we try yours with others. She went through the procedure again, and once more. Ah, you can be a donor for Bill Darden. I will note that on your card and his. Now, you know the procedure. Here are the samples, clearly labeled. Each must be tested against the others. Donors against patients. When that is done, we must test donors against each other, although this is not so critical. Then we will know, in case we must someday give one of you a transfusion. Shouldn't you be drawing blood for Darden? Maureen tried to remember him. He'd come to the stronghold late, and was let in because his mother lived here. He'd been in Chief Hartman's group in the battle. I gave him a pint already, Leonila said. Rick Delante. We have no way to store whole blood except as now, in the donor. When Darden requires more, I will send for you. Now I must go back to the ward. If you truly wish to help, you may continue with the cross-matching. Maureen spoiled the first test, but when she was careful, she found it wasn't difficult, merely tedious. The work wasn't made easier by the smells from the sewage works nearby, but there wasn't much choice about that. They needed the heat from the fermenting boilers. By running the extraction through City Hall and the hospital, they got that heat free, but at the cost of the ripe smells. Once Leonila came in and removed a patient sample and card. She didn't explain. It wasn't needed. Maureen reached for the card and looked at the name. One of the Aramson girls, age 16, wounded while throwing a dynamite bomb. "With penicillin I might have saved her," Leonila said. "But there is none, and there will never be any." "We can't make it," Maureen demanded. Leonila shook her head. "Sulfa, perhaps, but not the other antibiotics. That would require more equipment than we will have for years. Precise temperature regulation. High-speed centrifuges. No, we must learn to live without penicillin." She grimaced. "Which means that a simple cut untreated can be a death sentence. People must be made to understand that. We cannot ignore hygiene and first aid. Wash all cuts, and we will soon be out of tetanus vaccine, although perhaps that can be made. Perhaps." The crossbow was large and wound with a wheel. Harvey Randall turned it with effort, then laid the long, thin shaft into the weapon. He looked up at Brad Wagoner. "I feel like I ought to have on a black mask." Wagoner shuddered. "Get it over," he said. Harvey took careful aim. The crossbow was set on a large tripod, and the sights were good. He stood on the ridge above Battle Valley. That name would stick, he thought. He aimed the crossbow at a still figure down below. The figure moved slightly. Harvey checked the sights again, then stood aside. "Okay," he said. He gently pulled the lanyard. The steel springs of the bow gave a humming sound, and the traveler block clattered. The shaft flew out, over a yard long, a thin steel rod with metal feathering at the end. It went in a flat trajectory and embedded itself in the figure below. The hands jerked convulsively, then were still. They hadn't seen the face. At least this one hadn't screamed.
"There's another, about 40 yards to the left," Wagoner said. "I'll take that one."
"Thanks." Harvey turned away. It was too damned personal. Rifles would be better, or machine guns. A machine gun was very impersonal. If you shot someone with a machine gun, you could persuade yourself that the gun had done it. But the crossbow had to be wound with your own muscle power. Personal. There was nothing else to do. The valley was death to enter. In the cold night, the mustard had condensed, and now small streamers of the yellow gas were sometimes visible. No one could enter that valley. They could leave the enemy. Thank God all the stronghold wounded had been taken out before the gas attack, although Harvey knew that Al Hardy would have ordered the attack even if they hadn't been. They could leave the enemy wounded, or they could kill them. And they couldn't spare rifle or machine gun ammunition for the purpose. The crossbow bolts were recoverable. After the first good rain, or after a few days of warmth, the gas would be dispersed. It made good fertilizer. So would the dead. Battle Valley would be good cropland next spring. Now it was a slaughterhouse. We won. Victory. Harvey tried to recall the elation he'd felt the night before, the sense of life he'd had when he woke in the morning, and he knew he'd be able to. This was horrible work, but it was needed. They couldn't leave the Brotherhood's wounded to suffer. They'd die soon enough anyway. Better to kill them cleanly. And it was the last. No more wars. Now they could build a civilization. The Brotherhood had done the stronghold's work. They had cleared out much of the area near the stronghold. It wouldn't take a big expedition to go looking for salvage. Harvey kept his thoughts on that, on what they could find, on the wonders out there that they could search for and bring home. When he heard the bow, Harvey turned back. His turn. Let Brad be alone for a moment. The blood typing was done, and she'd visited the wounded. That had been tough, but not as bad as she'd thought. She knew why, but she didn't think about it. It wasn't too bad in the hospital, because the worst cases had already died. Maureen wondered if they'd been helped. Leonila and Doc Valdemar and his psychiatrist wife, Ruth, knew their limits, knew that many who had inhaled mustard or taken gut shots were finished because they didn't have the drugs and equipment it would take to save them. And the mustard cases would end up blind anyway, most of them. Had the doctors been more than choosers of the slain? Maureen didn't want to ask. She left the hospital. In City Hall, they were preparing for a party, a victory celebration. And we damned well deserve it, Maureen thought. We can mourn the dead, but we have to go on living, and these people have worked and bled and died for this moment, for the celebration that said the fighting was over, that the hammer had done its worst, and now it was time to rebuild. Joanna and Rosa Wagner were shouting with joy. They'd got a lamp burning. It works, Joanna said. Hi, Maureen. We've got the lamp burning on methanol. It didn't give off much light, but it would do. At the end of the big central book-lined room, some of the children were setting up punch bowls. Mulberry wine, really quite good. Well, not too bad. A case of Cokes someone had saved. And there would be food, mostly stew, and you didn't want to know what was in it. Rats and squirrels weren't really very different kinds of animals, nor did cat taste much different from rabbit. There wouldn't be many vegetables in the stew. Potatoes were scarce and terribly valuable. There were oats, though. Two of Gordy Vance's scouts had come down with oats, carefully separated, the scrawny ones for eating, and the best separated out to be kept as seed. The Sierra was full of wild oats. And Scotland had built a national cuisine on oats. Tonight they'd find out what haggis tasted like. She went through the main hall, where women and children were putting up decorations, bright-colored drapes now used as wall hangings, whatever might add a festive air. The mayor's office was through a door at the far end. Her father, Al Hardy, Mayor Seitz, and George Christopher were in there with Eileen Hamner. Their conversation stopped abruptly as she entered. Maureen greeted George and got an answer, but he seemed slightly nervous, somehow made to feel guilty in her presence. Or was she imagining it? She wasn't imagining the silence in the room. "Go on with what you were doing," she said.
"We were just talking about things," Al Hardy said. "I don't know if you'd be interested."
Maureen laughed.
"Don't worry about it. Go on."
"Because if you're going to treat me like a goddamn princess," she thought, "I can sure as hell learn what's going on."
"Yes, well, it's a bit of an ugly subject," Al Hardy said.
"So?" She took a seat next to her father. He didn't look good. He didn't look good at all, and Maureen knew he wouldn't live through the winter. The doctors at Bethesda had told her he would have to take things a lot easier, and there was no way he could do that. She put her hand on his arm and smiled, and he returned it.
"Tell Al I'll be all right," she said.
His smile broadened.
"Sure about that, kitten?"
"Yes, I can do my part."
"Al," Jellison said.
"Yes, sir.
It's about the prisoners. What do we do with them?"
"There weren't many of their wounded in the hospital," Maureen said. "I'd have thought there would be more."
"Oh,"
Hardy nodded. "The rest are being taken care of.
It's the 41 men and 6 women who surrendered that we've got to worry about. He held up his hand and ticked off points on his fingers.
I see the following alternatives. 1, we can take them in as citizens.
Never,
George Christopher growled. 2, we can take them in as slaves. 3, we can let them go. 4, we can kill them.
We don't let them go either, George said. Let them go, they'll rejoin the Brotherhood. Where else would they go? And the Brotherhood is still bigger than we are. Don't forget that. They put up a good fight after the first 10 or 15 miles. They've still got leaders, some trucks, mortars. Sure, we captured a lot of their weapons, but they're still out there.
He grinned wolfishly.
But I bet they don't ever stick their noses our way again.
Then he looked thoughtful.
Slaves. I can think of a lot we could do with slaves.
Yes, Hardy nodded agreement. So can I. Brute labor. Turning compressor pumps so we can have refrigeration. Muscle power for hand lathes. Grinding lenses. Even pulling plows. There's a lot of work nobody wants to do.
But slavery, Maureen protested. That's horrible.
Is it? Would you like it better if we call it imprisonment at hard labor? Hardy asked. Would their lives be so much worse than they were as part of the Brotherhood, or worse than convicts in prisons before the hammer?
No, Maureen said. It's not them I'm thinking of. It's us. Do we want to be the kind of people who keep slaves?
Then let's kill them and get it over with, George Christopher said, because we're sure as hell not going to just turn them loose, inside or outside.
Why can't we just let them go? Maureen demanded.
I already told you, George said. They'll go back to the cannibals.
Is the Brotherhood all that dangerous now? Maureen asked.
Not to us, Christopher said. They won't come here again.
And by spring there won't be many of them left, I suspect, Hal Hardy added. They don't have much organization for winter. Or if they do, the ones we capture don't know about it.
Maureen fought the feeling that threatened her. It's all pretty horrible, she said.
What can we afford?
Senator Jellison asked. His voice was low, conserving energy.
Civilizations have the morality and ethics they can afford. Right now, we don't have much, so we can't afford much. We can't take care of our own wounded, much less theirs. So all we can afford to do for theirs is put them out of their misery. Now what can we afford to do with the other prisoners? Maureen's right. We can't let ourselves become barbarians. But our abilities may not be up to our intentions.
Maureen patted her father's arm.
That's what I figured out somewhere in the last week. But if we can't afford much, then we have to build so that we can. What we don't dare do is get used to evil. We have to hate it, even if we can't do anything else.
Which doesn't settle what we do with the prisoners, George Christopher said. I vote for killing them. I'll do it myself.
And he hadn't brought back any from his pursuit, Maureen knew, and he'd never understand. Yet in his way he was a good man. He'd shared everything he had. He worked longer than anyone else, and harder, and not just for himself.
No, Maureen said. All right, we can't let them go, and we can't keep them as citizens. If all we can afford is slavery, then keep them as slaves. And put them to work so we can afford something more. Only we don't call them slaves either, because that makes it too easy to think like a slave master. We can put them to work, but we call them prisoners of war, and treat them as prisoners of war.
Hardy looked confused. He'd never seen Maureen so assertive. He looked from her to the senator, but all he got from the senator was the look of a man tired unto death.
All right, Al said. Eileen, we'll have to organize a POW camp.
The Final Decision. The peasant is an eternal man, independent of all cultures. The piety of the real peasant is older than Christianity. His gods are older than those of any of the higher religions. Oswald Spengler, The Decline of the West.
The van had not been new when the comet fell. In these past few months it had aged many years. It had bulled its paths across roadless lands and through fresh sea bottoms. It stank of fish. Maintenance had been impossible, and continual rain had caused years of corrosion. Half-blinded, with one headlamp working, it seemed to know that its era was dead. It groaned, it limped, and with every jolt of its dying shock absorbers, Tim Hamner felt a needle of pain stab his hip. Shifting gears was worse. His right leg wouldn't reach the clutch pedal. He used his left, and it was like an ice pick being wiggled in the bone. Still, he drove fast across the potholed road, balancing the jouncing against the need for speed. Cal Christopher was on guard at the barricade. His weapon was an army submachine gun. He carried a bottle of old FedCal in the other hand, and he beamed, he swaggered, he wanted to talk.
"Hamner, good to see you!"
He thrust the bottle through the truck window.
"Have a drink, hey! What happened to your face?"
"Sand," said Tim. "Look, I've got three wounded in the truck bed. Can somebody drive for me?"
"Gee, there are only two of us here. Rest are celebrating. You guys won, huh? We heard you'd had a fight and beat them off."
"The wounded," Tim said. "Is there somebody at the hospital?"
"You better believe it. We had wounded here, too. But we won. They weren't expecting it, Tim. It was beautiful. Forrester's brew really clobbered them. They won't stop running until..."
"They did stop, and I can't take time to talk, Cal."
"Yeah, right. Well, everybody's celebrating at City Hall, and the hospital's right next door, so you'll get plenty of help. They may not be sober, but..."
"The barricade, Cal. I can't help you with it. I got hit myself."
"Oh, too bad."
Cal moved the log aside, and Tim drove on. The road was dark, and none of the houses were lit. He saw no one along the way, but the going was easier here. The potholes had all been filled in. He rounded a bend and saw the town. City Hall glowed softly through the dark, candlelight and lanterns in every window. Not an impressive sight after the brilliant glare of the atomic plant, but still a sign of celebration. The crowd was too big for the building. It had spilled onto the street despite the tiny flurries of snow. People formed tight clumps against the chill and the wind, but their laughter reached him for all that. Tim parked next door in front of the county convalescent home. People moved toward him from outside City Hall as he climbed from the cab. One was running, off balance. Eileen, her sunburst smile wide and familiar.
"Easy,"
he cried, but too late. She crashed into him and hugged him tight, laughing while he tried to maintain balance for both. Agony twisted and grated in the bone.
"Easy! Jesus Christ, there's a piece of metal in my hip!"
She jumped back as if scalded.
"What happened?"
And saw his face. Her smile faded.
"What happened?"
"Mortar shell. It went off just in front of us. We were up on the cooling tower with the radio. It blasted the radio to bits, and it shredded the cop, Wingate, his name was. And I was standing right between them, Eileen. Right between them. All I got was a blast of sand from the sandbags and this thing in my hip. Are you okay?"
"Oh, sure. And you're all right, aren't you? You can walk. You're safe, thank God."
Before Tim could interrupt, she went on.
"Tim, we won. We must have killed half of the cannibals, and the rest are still running. George Christopher chased them for 50 miles.
"They'll never try us again,"
someone boasted, and Tim realized he was surrounded. The man who spoke was a stranger, an Indian by his looks. He handed Tim a bottle.
"Last Irish whiskey in the world," he said.
"Should save it for Irish coffee,"
someone laughed.
"But there ain't no more coffee."
The bottle was nearly empty. Tim didn't drink. He shouted,
"There are wounded in the back. I need stretcher bearers."
He called again.
"Stretcher bearers and stretchers, come to that."
Some of the merrymakers moved toward the hospital. Good. Eileen was frowning, more in puzzlement than sadness. She kept looking at Tim to be sure he was still there, that he was all right.
"We heard about the attack on the plant," she said. "But you beat them. None of our people hurt."
"That was the first attack," Tim said. "They hit us again, this afternoon."
"This afternoon?"
The Indian was incredulous.
But they were running. We chased them.
They stopped running, Tim said. Eileen put her mouth close to his ear.
Maureen will want to know about Johnny Baker.
He's dead. She looked at him, shocked. Men came with stretchers. The wounded were in the back of the van, wrapped in cocoons of blankets. One was Jack Ross. The men carrying the stretchers stopped in surprise at seeing the others. Both were black. "Mayor Allen's police," Tim told them. He wanted to help carry, but he was lucky to carry himself. He found the stick Horry Jackson's fisherman had given him and used it for a cane as he limped into the hospital. Leonila Malik directed them into a heated front room. It had a large office table set up as a surgery. They put the stretchers on the floor, and she examined the men quickly and carefully. First, Jack Ross. She used her stethoscope, frowned, moved the instrument, then lifted a hand and pressed hard on the thumbnail. It went white and stayed that way. Silently, she pulled the blanket over his head and went to the next. The policeman was conscious.
"Can you understand me?" she asked.
"Yeah. Are you the Russian spacewoman?"
"Yes. How many times were you hit?"
6. Shrapnel. Guts are on fire," he said.
As she felt for the pulse, Tim limped out of the room. Eileen followed, hugging at his arm.
"You've been hit. Stay here," she said.
"I'm not bleeding. I can come back. Somebody's got to tell George about his brother-in-law, and there's something else I have to do. We've got to have reinforcements, fast." He saw it in her face. Nobody here wanted that kind of news. They'd fought and won, and they didn't want to hear that there was more fighting to do.
"We don't have a doctor at the plant," Tim said. "Nobody wanted to dig that steel out of me."
"Get back in that hospital," Eileen commanded.
"I will. But the cops come first. They're hurt worse than me. The plant nurse squeezed sulfur in the hole and covered it with sterile gauze. It'll be okay for a while. I've got to talk to Hardy."
It was hard to keep his thoughts in order. His hip felt like fire, and the pain kept him confused. He let Eileen help support his weight as they crossed the narrow way toward City Hall. Damn, they were surrounded again. Steve Cox, Jellison's foreman, asked,
"Hamner, what happened?"
Someone else bellowed, "Let him alone! Let him tell all of us at once!" And another,
"Hamner, are you going to drink that?"
Tim discovered the near-empty bottle still in his hand. He surrendered it.
"Hey!" Steve Cox yelled. "Give that back to him! Come on, man, have a drink with us! We won!"
"Can't. Have to talk to the senator. And Hardy, we've got to have help."
He felt Eileen stiffen. The others looked as she had. They hated him for his bad news.
"We can't take another attack," Tim said. "They did us too much damage."
"No, it's got to be over," Eileen whispered.
Tim heard.
"You thought it was all over," Tim said.
"Everybody does."
Eileen's face showed unbearable grief. It should have melted Tim Hamner, but it didn't.
"Nobody wants to fight again," Eileen said. "We won't have to,"
Joanna McPherson's high, clear voice cried.
"We slaughtered the sons of bitches, Tim."
She edged up to him and put her shoulder under his other armpit.
"There aren't enough of them left to fight. They'll split up and pretend they never heard of the Brotherhood. And that won't work either. We'll know them."
Joanna had tasted blood. Suddenly, she said,
"Is Mark all right?"
"Mark's fine." Tim was just beginning to realize what he was up against. A hopeless task. But it had to be done. They had to understand. He added,
"Healthy and happy and cleaner than you are. They've got hot showers and washing machines at the power plant."
It could help. In a room off the meeting hall at City Hall, Rick Delante argued for his honor against Ginger Dow, who seemed determined to take him home with her. She was also indecently amused by the whole thing.
"You don't have to marry me, you know."
When he didn't answer, she laughed. She was a sturdy matron in her mid-30s, whose long brown hair had been brushed to a soft glow, possibly for the first time since Hammerfall.
"Although, if you like everything, you could move in. And if you don't, leave in the morning. Nobody will care," This isn't Mississippi, you know. There's probably not another black woman other than the cannibals for 1,000 miles.
Well, I admit it makes me nervous, Rick said. The whole situation, but it isn't just that. I'm in mourning.
He would have been less nervous if he and Ginger hadn't been trying to raise their voices against the singing in the big room next door. The tunes seemed to be optional, but at least they were loud. He never shaved a whisker from off his horny hide. He hammered in the bristles and bit them off inside. Ginger lost some of her smile.
We're all in mourning for someone, Rick. We don't let it get to us. The last I ever saw of Gil, my husband, he was off to Porterville for lunch with his lawyer. Then bang, I think the dam must have got them both.
I saw my logger lover go shouldering through the snow, going gaily homeward at 48 below.
It's not morning time, she told him. It's time to celebrate.
Her mouth puckered into a pout.
There are a lot of men, lots more than women, and nobody's ever told me I was ugly.
Ugly or not, Rick said.
Was it the astronaut's scalp she wanted to collect, or the black man's, or was she husband hunting? Rick found he was flattered, but the memories of the house in El Lago were too vivid. He opened the connecting door.
The wind, it tried to freeze him. It tried its level best. At 100 degrees below zero, he buttoned up his vest.
The city hall was also the town library, police station, and jail. The large, book-lined meeting room had been decorated with paintings and drapes. They absorbed some of the sound, but it was still a damned noisy party. Rick found Brad Wagner at the end of the big room. Wagner was staring at something in a glass display case.
"Where did that come from?" Rick asked. "Somebody up here collects Steuben glass."
Wagner shrugged.
"Don't know. Right classy whale, isn't it?"
Wagner had a large bandage around his forehead. It looked impressive, like a scene from the Red Badge of Courage. He didn't tell people about it, though, that he'd slung a thermite grenade with too much vigor and fallen onto a rock and rolled downhill until he thought he was going to be gassed, but he wasn't. He was pretty well gassed now, on bourbon and water. He told Rick,
"At least we won't ever have to do that again."
He'd been saying that a lot. Happiness was contagious. Rick wanted to join in. If only he could quit worrying about that damned power plant and about Johnny, and forget El Lago. He decided to go over to the hospital and do some honest work. He wouldn't be spoiling anybody's party at the hospital. As he made his way toward the door, Tim Hamner came in, a girl at each arm and a crowd around him all trying to talk at once. Rick shoved toward Hamner. The noise level doubled. Hamner kept moving toward the back of the hall, toward the mayor's office, and Rick followed. A number of people shouted for silence, adding to the general noise level. Eileen Hamner saw Rick, slipped from under Tim's arm, and came toward him.
"There's something I have to tell you," she said.
Rick knew at once. It turned him cold with the chill of a man about to faint.
"How did Johnny buy it?" he asked.
"Tim says saving their asses. That's all I know."
He felt his knees weaken, but he stayed stiffly upright.
"I should have made him let me go," he said to nobody. "Now there are 3 astronauts left in the world. Does Maureen know?"
"Not yet. Where is she?"
"Last I saw, in the mayor's office with her father."
The senator wasn't going to like this much either.
"I'll come with you."
He pushed through, making a way for both of them. So Johnny was dead. Now everybody he loved was dead. The hammer had got them all. He felt a crazy impulse to laugh. America's record was still perfect. Not 1 astronaut lost on space duty.
"Saving their asses from what?" he demanded.
But Eileen was too far away, and the noise was too great. Someone passed Tim a bottle. Scotch. This time he drank and carried the bottle into the mayor's office. The leaders were there, the senator sitting behind the mayor's desk, Al Hardy hovering over him, Maureen, Chief Hartman, the mayor. They looked happy, triumphant. Tim resented that. He knew he was irrational, that they deserved their celebration, but his grief was too great. He limped on into the office, pleased to see their grins fade as they saw the way he walked, the expression on his face. He felt Eileen and Rick Delante crowd in behind him. Then the door was closed.
"You were attacked again," Al Hardy asked.
"Yes." Tim looked at Maureen. She knew. She knew from his face. No point in being gentle about it.
"General Baker is dead. We stopped their attack, but just barely. And the rest of it I want to say to everybody."
He kept his attention on the senator. He didn't want to see Maureen's face. Hardy turned to the senator.
"All right with me," he said. Jellison nodded, and Hardy went past Tim to the door. "Get it quiet out there," he said.
Steve Cox went to the podium and rapped for attention, while Hardy led Tim over and a dozen hands helped him on the platform. Someone moved the senator's chair to the doorway so that he could hear. The mayor and Chief Hartman stood behind him, leaning forward. Tim couldn't see Maureen. He braced himself on the lectern, facing hundreds of eyes, and drank more scotch. It warmed him. The room was almost quiet. No talking except for newcomers crowding in by the door and shushing noises from those already inside. He had never spoken before a live audience in real life, before the comet fell. They were too close, too real. He could smell them. He saw George Christopher making his way through the crowd like an icebreaker, moving triumphantly, like Beowulf displaying the arm of the monster Grendel. And hell, they all looked like that. Triumphant. And waiting expectantly.
"Good news first," he said. "The power plant's still running. We were attacked this afternoon. We beat them, but it was close. Some of us are dead, and some of us are wounded, and more will die of the wounds. You already know that most of the Brotherhood wasn't even there."
Applause and triumphant laughter erupted. Tim should have expected that. From the warriors who'd decimated the new Brotherhood's main force, but he hadn't. He was jolted. Where did these yahoos get off, drinking and dancing and bragging, while the men and women Tim Hamner had left behind waited to die? When quiet came, he spoke in anger.
"General Baker is dead. The new Brotherhood isn't," Tim said.
He watched the reaction. Anger. Incredulity.
"They won't come here again,"
someone shouted. There were more cheers.
"Let him talk. What happened?"
George Christopher demanded. The room was silent again.
"The Brotherhood came at us with boats the first time," Tim said. "It wasn't hard to drive them off. Then we heard on the radio that you were fighting them, and we figured that would be the end of it, when you said you'd won."
He gripped the lectern, remembering the shouting celebration they'd held in the San Joaquin plant, after the news of the stronghold victory.
"But they did come back. Today. They had a big raft, sandbags around it, mortars. They stayed out of range of anything we had, and they were blowing us apart. One of the shells got a steam line, live steam, and Price's people had a hell of a time putting it back together. Another shell got Jack Ross."
Tim watched George Christopher lose his triumphant grin.
"Jack was alive when we took him off the boat and put him in the van. But he was dead when we got here," Tim said. "Another mortar went off just in front of me. It hit the sandbags we'd put on top of the cooling tower, where we had the radio. It killed the guy next to me and blew the radio apart, and it punched a piece of shrapnel into my hip bone. It's still there. They kept that up, standing off where we couldn't shoot back. Price's people had made some cannon, muzzle loaders made out of pipe powered by compressed air. They weren't accurate enough. We couldn't hit the barge, and the damned mortar shells kept dropping on us. Baker took some troops out in boats. That didn't do any good either. The Brotherhood had machine guns and the boats couldn't get close enough. They had those sandbags anyway. Finally, Baker brought the boats back. He put everybody off."
In the corner of his eye, Tim saw Maureen in the doorway of the mayor's office. She stood behind her father, her hand on his shoulder. Eileen was near her.
"We had a racing boat we used as a tug," Tim said. "Cindy Lou. Johnny told Barry Price, 'I used to be a fighter pilot,
They always taught us there was one way not to miss. Then he took Cindy Lou out at top speed and rammed her right into the barge, covered the raft with burning gasoline. He carried some extra gasoline and thermite on the deck. After that, the Brotherhood came on with their other boats, but they had to come in range of our stuff, and we did some damage. Finally they left.
Ran away, George Christopher said.
They always run.
They didn't run, Tim said. They retreated. There was some crazy white-haired guy standing in plain sight on one of the boats. We kept shooting at him, but we never hit him. He was shouting at them to kill us. Last I heard, he still was. They'll be back.
Tim paused to see what effect he'd had. Not enough. He'd killed the gay mood of the party, but all he saw was resentment and sorrow. Nothing else.
They killed 14 of us, counting Jack. Hit maybe 3 times that many, and a lot of them will die. There's a nurse and some medicines, but no doctor. We need one. We need another radio.
Their looks, anger, sorrow, resentment. They knew what he'd say next. He went doggedly on.
What we need most is reinforcements. We can't take another attack like that one. I don't think gas bombs will do it either. We need guns. Machine guns you took from the New Brotherhood would help. But mostly we need men, because it takes just about all the power plant staff on standby just to keep the place going in case there's a hit on the plant. Price's people are...
He fumbled for words. Hell, it would sound corny. So what?
They're magnificent. I saw a guy wade into a cloud of live steam. Live steam. He walked right into it to turn a valve, to turn the steam off. He was still alive when I left, but there wasn't any point in bringing him here. Another of the power workers spliced live wires, thousands of volts, and he worked on it hot while mortar bombs fell around him. Baker's dead. They're still alive, and they need help. We need help. I'm going back.
He couldn't look at Eileen as he said that. He felt someone behind him. Al Hardy had climbed onto the podium. He came to the left side of the lectern and stood there with his hand held up for attention. When he spoke, it was with an orator's voice that rolled about the large room.
"Thank you, Tim," he said. "You are persuasive. Of course you want to go back. But the question is, have we anything to gain? How many people are there at the nuclear plant? Because we have boats, and now we have food, and we can bring all of them here. It will not be hard to evacuate that plant, and I'm sure we will have no trouble getting volunteers for the job."
Harvey Randall came in from the hospital in time to hear Tim's report begin. He'd come in the back way, through the mayor's office, and he found himself next to Maureen. When Tim told of what had happened to Baker, he was there with his hand on her arm, but lightly. She wasn't going to faint or scream. She may have been crying, but even that wasn't obvious, and Harvey didn't want to be obtrusively present, not now. He was thinking, son of a bitch, Maureen was taking it better than Delante. The black astronaut seemed ready to murder. Well, that figured. Baker's other 2 companions weren't in the room. Leonila was operating on the gunshot policeman, with Comrade helping her. They called him Comrade now. Brigadier Peter Jackoff was the last communist and proud of it, and it avoided the difficulty of his name. The senator's face was ashen gray, and his hands were clasped tightly in his lap. There went one of his plans, Harvey thought. It struck him then. One prince was dead, and one was enthralled by a witch. George Christopher wasn't alone. Marie stood with him. Marie, the only woman in the room in stockings and heels, as well as skirt and sweater and simple jewelry. And she and George stood as a couple, not as 2 single people. Whenever anyone got too close to Marie or ogled her too suggestively, George's face clouded. 3 princes. One was killed by ogres. One was spellbound by a witch. The 3rd was standing beside the princess, and the enemy had been defeated. The need for fighting men was not over, but it was no longer critical. Now the stronghold needed builders, And that Harvey Randall could do. I'm crown prince now, he thought. Son of a bitch. But Tim Hamner was calling for a new battle. Harvey, fresh from his work with the crossbow, was thinking helplessly, shut up, shut up. When Al Hardy came up to offer the power plant personnel refuge at the stronghold, Harvey wanted to cheer, and some of Hardy's audience did cheer. But Rick Delante still looked like murder, and Tim Hamner.
We won't leave, Tim said. Use your boats to bring us men and guns and ammunition. Not for us to run away. We are not leaving.
Be reasonable, Al Hardy said. His voice projected. It reached all corners of the hall. It projected warmth, friendliness, understanding, a politician's basic skill, and Al Hardy was well trained. Tim was outclassed.
We can feed everyone. We can use engineers and technical people. We lost people to the New Brotherhood, but we lost none of our food. We even captured some of their stores. We not only have enough to eat, we have enough to be well fed during the winter. We can feed everyone, including Deke Wilson's women and children, and the few survivors from his area. The New Brotherhood has been hurt, badly hurt.
He paused for the cheers again, and went on just as they died, his timing perfect.
And is now far too weak to attack us again. By spring, the few surviving cannibals will be starving.
Or eating each other, someone shouted.
Exactly, Hardy said. And by spring we'll be able to take their land. Tim, not only do we not need to turn any of our friends away, we need new people to work the lands we have taken or will have in spring. I don't mean for your friends to run. I mean to welcome them as our guests, friends, as new citizens here. Does everyone agree?
There were shouts.
Hell yeah! Glad to have them.
Tim Hamner spread his hands, palms outward, pleading. He wobbled on his damaged hip. There were the beginnings of tears in his eyes.
Don't you understand? The power plant. We can't leave it, and without help the New Brotherhood will destroy it.
No, damn it, Harvey muttered. He felt Maureen stiffen.
No more wars, Harvey said. We've had enough. Hardy's right.
He looked for approval from Maureen, but only got a blank stare. George Christopher was laughing. It carried, like Al Hardy's voice.
They're too damn weak to attack anything, he shouted. First we crunched them, then you did. They won't stop running until they're back to Los Angeles. Who needs to worry about them? We chased the bastards 50 miles ourselves.
More laughter in the room. Then Maureen broke away from Harvey and moved past her father. When she spoke, her voice did not carry the way Hardy's did, but it commanded silence, and the crowd listened to her.
They still have their weapons, she said. And Tim, you said their leaders are still alive.
Well, one of them is, Hamner said, the crazy preacher.
Then some of them will try to destroy the power plant again, Maureen said. As long as he's alive, he'll keep trying.
She turned to Hardy.
Al, you know that. You heard Hugo Beck. You know.
Yes, Hardy said, we can't protect the plant. But again, I invite everyone there to come live here, with us.
Damn right, the Brotherhood's no threat to us, George Christopher said. They won't be back.
But they...
Whatever Al Hardy had been about to say, he cut himself off at a wave from Senator Jellison.
Yes, sir, Hardy asked.
Do you want to come up here, Senator?
No, Jellison stood.
Let's cut this short, he said.
His voice was thick with either drunkenness or exhaustion, and everyone knew he hadn't been drinking.
We are agreed, are we not? The Brotherhood is not strong enough to harm us here in our valley. But their leaders are still alive, and they have enough strength to destroy the power plant. It is not that they are strong, but that the plant is fragile.
Hamner jumped on that. He was interrupting the senator, but he didn't care. He knew he should speak carefully, weighing every word, but he was too tired. The sense of urgency was too strong.
Yes, we're fragile.
like that whale. He pointed to the glass case. Like the last piece of Steuben crystal in the world. If the power stops for one day...
Beautiful and fragile, Al Hardy's voice cut in. Senator, did you have something else to say? The massive head shook.
Only this. Think carefully. This may be the most important decision we have made since that day.
He sat heavily.
Go on, please, he said.
Hardy looked worriedly at the senator, then motioned to one of the women near him. He spoke to her, too low for Harvey to hear what he said, and the woman left. Then he stood at the lectern again.
Fragile and beautiful, he said, but not much use to a farming community.
No use, Tim exploded. Power, clean clothes, light.
Luxuries, Al Hardy said.
Are they worth our lives? We're a farm community. The balance is delicate. Not many weeks ago we did not know if we would live through the winter. Now we know we can. A few days ago we did not know whether we could resist the cannibals. We did. We are safe, and we have work to do, and we cannot afford more people for a needless war.
He looked to George Christopher.
You agree, George? Neither of us runs from a fight. But do we have to run to one?
Not me, Christopher said. We won our war.
There were murmurs of agreement. Harvey stepped forward, intending to join in.
Not another war. Not another afternoon with the crossbow.
He felt Maureen beside him. She looked up at him, pleading in her eyes.
Don't let them do this, she said. Make them understand.
She dropped her hand from Harvey's arm and bent over the senator.
Dad, tell them. We have to. To fight. To save that power plant.
Why? Jellison asked.
Haven't we had enough war? It doesn't matter. I couldn't order it. They wouldn't go.
They would. If you told them, they would.
He didn't answer. She turned back to Harvey. Randall stared at her without comprehension.
Listen, he said. Listen to Al.
Reinforcements wouldn't be enough, Tim, Al Hardy was saying. Chief Hartman and the senator and the mayor and I, we looked at the problem this afternoon. We hadn't forgotten you, and the cost is too high. You said it yourself. The plant is fragile. It's not enough to put a garrison in there to keep it filled with troops. You have to keep the Brotherhood from dropping one mortar shell in the right place. Tell me, if that plant worker hadn't turned off the steam valve, wouldn't that have done it?
Yes, Tim snarled. That would have finished us. So a 20-year-old kid parboiled himself to save the plant, and General Baker made his decision.
Tim, Tim, Hardy pleaded. You don't understand. It wouldn't do any good just to send reinforcements.
Look, I'll send volunteers, as many as want to go, and with plenty of food and ammunition.
Tim's face showed joy, but only for a moment.
But it won't do any good, and you know it. To save that power plant, we will have to send out all our strength.
Everyone, not to defend the plant, but to attack the new Brotherhood. Pursue them. Fight them. Wipe them out. Take all their weapons, then set up patrols around the edges of the lake. Keep the enemy at least a mile from the plant. It would take all our strength, Tim, and the cost would be horrible. But think about it, Hardy said. Patrols, spies, an army of occupation, all to stop one fanatic from getting one hit on one crucial piece of equipment and putting it out of commission for one day. That's the task, isn't it?
For now, Tim said. But given peace and quiet for a few weeks, Price will have number two online. Then, as long as either works, the other can be repaired.
The room full of survivors was sobering now, most of them, because the last of the liquor was as dead as the coffee supply. They muttered to each other, spoke, argued, and they seemed to Harvey to be divided in opinion. But the strength was against Tim, as it should be, Harvey thought. Not more war. But
He looked at Maureen. Now she was crying openly, because of Baker. Baker had made his choice, and Maureen wouldn't let him be wasted. Her eyes met his. "Talk to them," she said. "Make them understand." "I don't understand myself," Harvey said. "What we can afford," she said. "A civilization has the ethics it can afford. We can't afford much. We can't afford to take care of our enemies. You know about that." He shuddered. He knew about that. Leonila Malik came in the back way through the mayor's office. She bent over the senator. "I am told that you need me," she said.
"Who told you that?" Jellison demanded.
"Mr. Hardy."
"I'm all right. Get back to your hospital."
"Dr. Valdemar is on duty. I have a few minutes." She stood slightly behind the senator, and she watched him carefully, her expression professional and concerned.
"We must count the costs," Al Hardy was saying. "You ask us to risk everything. We have assured survival. We are alive. We have fought the last battle. Tim, electric lights are not worth throwing that away."
Tim Hamner swayed from exhaustion and pain.
"We won't leave," he said. "We'll fight, all of us."
But his voice was not strong. He sounded beaten.
"Do something," Maureen said. "Tell them."
She gripped Harvey's arm. "You tell them."
"I can't. But you're a hero now. Your force held them."
"You stand pretty high yourself," Harvey said.
"Let's both tell them," Maureen said. "Come with me. We'll talk to them together."
And that's a hell of an offer, Harvey thought. For the power plant itself. For Johnny Baker's memory. Because she was jealous of Marie with George Christopher. Whatever her motive, she just offered him the leadership of the stronghold, and her look made it plain that he wasn't going to get another such.
"We'd have to hold their territory," Al Hardy was saying. "Deke couldn't do it."
"We could," Tim cried. "You beat them. We could."
Hardy nodded gravely.
"Yes, I suppose we could. But first we have to take it, and we can't do that with magic weapons. Grenades and gas bombs aren't much use in the attack. We'd lose people, a lot of people. How many lives are your electric lights worth?"
"Many,"
Leonila Malik said. Her voice didn't carry very far.
"If I had had proper lights for the operating theater last night, I could have saved 10 more, at least."
Maureen was moving toward the platform. Harvey hesitated, then went with her. What would he say? Men would charge machine guns for a cause.
Viva la Republic! For king and country! Duty, honor, country! Remember the Alamo! Liberté, égalité, fraternité!
But nobody had ever gone over the top shouting,
"A higher standard of living!" or "Hot showers and electric razors!"
"And what about me?" he thought. "When I get up there, I'm committed. When the new Brotherhood comes over the water with their new raft and their mortars, I'd have to be first into the boats, first to attack, first to be blown apart. And what could I possibly be yelling that would make me do it?" He remembered the battle, the noise, loneliness, fear, the shame of running, the terror when you didn't. Running was a decision of the moment, but not running went on and on. A rational army would run away. He caught her arm to hold her back. She turned, and her look was full of concern. Sympathy. She spoke low, so no one else would hear.
"We all have to do our jobs," she said. "And this is right. Don't you see that?"
The short delay had been too much. Al Hardy was retiring, having made his point. The crowd was turning away, talking among themselves. Harvey heard snatches of conversation.
"Hell, I don't know. I sure as hell don't want to fight any more."
"Damn it, Baker got killed for that place. Wasn't that worth something?"
"I'm tired, Sue. Let's go home."
Before Hardy could leave the platform, Rick Delante barred his way.
"The senator said this was an important decision," he said. "Let's talk about it. Now."
Delanty was no longer planning murder, Harvey saw with relief, but he seemed determined.
"Al, you say we'll live through the winter. Let's talk about that."
Hardy shrugged.
"If you choose, I think it has all been said."
Delanty's grin was crafty, artificial.
"Oh, hell, Al, we're all here, and the liquor's gone, and tomorrow it's back to moving rocks. Let's talk it all out right now. We can survive the winter."
"Yes."
"But without coffee, that's all gone."
Hardy frowned.
"Yes."
"How are we fixed for clothing? There are glaciers coming, and the clothes are rotting off our backs. Can we dig anything out of underwater department stores?"
"Some plastics, maybe. It can wait, now that we don't have to worry about the new Brotherhood getting there first."
Oddly, there was no cheering this time.
"We'll have to make the most of our clothing, or shoot it."
Hardy smiled.
"Transportation. The cars and trucks are dying like sterile beasts, aren't they? Will we have to eat the horses?"
Al Hardy ran his hands through his hair.
"No. For a while I thought... No. Horses don't breed fast, but we'll have the trucks for years yet."
"What else have we run out of? Penicillin?"
"Yes."
"Aspirin? And the liquor? No anesthetics of any kind?"
"We'll be able to ferment liquor."
"So, we'll live. Through this winter, and the next one, and the one after that."
Rick paused, but before Hardy could say anything, he thundered.
"As peasants! We have a ceremony here today, an award to the kid who caught the most rats this week, and we can look forward to that for the rest of our lives, to our kids growing up as rat catchers and swine herds. Honorable work, needed work. Nobody puts it down, but don't we want to hope for something better?"
"And we're going to keep slaves," Delanty said. "Not because we want to, because we need them. And we used to control the lightning."
The phrase struck Harvey Randall with a physical shock. He saw it hit the others, too. A lot of them. They stood, unable to turn away.
"Sure, we can huddle here in our valley," Delanty shouted. "We can stay here and be safe, and our kids can grow up herding pigs and shoveling sewage. There's a lot here to be proud of, because it's so much more than what might have been. But is it enough... Is it enough for us to be safe when we leave everybody else out in the cold? You all say how sorry you are to have to turn people away, to have to send people outside. Well, we've got the chance now. We can make all of outside, the whole damn San Joaquin Valley, as safe as we are. Or there's another way. We can stay here, safe as ground squirrels. But if we take the easy way this time... We'll take it next time, and the next, and the next, and in 50 years your kids will hide under the bed when they hear the thunder, the way everybody used to hide from the great thunder gods. Peasants always believe in thunder gods. And the comet, we know what it was. In 10 more years we'd have been able to push the damn thing out of our way. I've been in space. I won't go there again. But your children could. Hell yes, give us that electric plant and 20 years and we'll be in space again. We know how, and all it takes is power, and that power's right out there, not 50 miles from here, if we've just got the guts enough to save it. Think about it. Those are the choices. Go on and be good peasants, safe peasants, superstitious peasants, or have worlds to conquer again. To control the lightning again."
He paused, but not long enough to let anyone speak.
"I'm going," he said. "Leonila?"
"Certainly."
She moved toward the platform.
"And I," Comrade General Jakov shouted from the back of the room. "For the lightning."
"Now." Harvey slapped Maureen's butt and bounded ahead of her onto the platform, moving quickly before the moment died away. Decisions were simple now that he knew what he'd be shouting.
"Task Force Randall!"
"Sure,"
someone shouted, and then Maureen joined him, and another farmer came forward, and Tim Hamner, and Mayor Seitz.
Marie Vance and George Christopher were arguing. Good. Marie belonged to Task Force Randall, unless there was a Task Force Christopher. Christopher would join them. Al Hardy stood in confusion, wanting to speak, but held by the command in Maureen's eyes. He could stop them, Harvey Randall thought. It wouldn't take much to stop them. Once everyone's committed, it will be hard to back down. But right now, this bandwagon can be stopped. Or it can be shoved forward so hard nothing can stop it, and Al Hardy has that power. Hardy was looking past Maureen now, at the senator. The old man was half rising from his chair, and he gasped for breath before he fell back into it. Leonila ran toward him, but he waved her away, beckoning to Hardy.
Al!
He gasped. Leonila had her medical bag in the office. She threw it open and seized a hypodermic needle, fought away the senator's feeble resistance as she ripped open his jacket and shirt. She swabbed his chest quickly and thrust the needle directly into his chest, near the heart. Al Hardy tore through the crowd like a madman. He knelt beside the gasping man. Jellison thrashed and writhed in the chair, his hands reaching for his chest while Chief Hartman and the others held them. His eyes focused on Al Hardy.
Al? Yes, sir?
Hardy's voice was choked, almost inaudible. He bent closer.
Al? Give my children the lightning again.
The voice was clear, projecting through the hall, and for a moment Jellison's eyes were bright. But then he slumped into the chair, and they heard only a thin whisper that faded to nothing.
Give them the lightning again.
Epilogue. The Earth is just too small and fragile a basket for the human race to keep all its eggs in. Robert A. Heinlein. Tim Hamner stood at the top of a low hill. Paper crackled in his breast pocket when he shifted weight. The long slope behind him buzzed with activity. Animal teams dragged harrows through the hard soil, while methanol-powered tractors worked with deep plows in adjacent fields. Myriads of white flecks gleamed in the soil behind the harrows. Enriched by mustard gas and the defeat of the new Brotherhood Army, this land would produce in abundance. Three electric carts hummed along the road below. Another stood beside Tim Hamner, ready for his use. It was time to get back down the hill and go to work, but he stood a few moments longer, enjoying bright sunshine and the clear blue of spring. It was a glorious day. Before him was the San Joaquin Sea. Much of what had been underwater was now a vast swampland. Directly ahead was a low island in the sea, the prisoner colony, where those of the Brotherhood who hadn't wanted to go into permanent exile worked to grow crops. Jakoff's Preserve. They called him Comrade now, and Comrade hadn't given up communism. But Marxist theory said that history followed definite stages, slave society to feudal, feudal to capitalist, and the valley was barely past the slave stage of history. The Earth would not be ready for communism for a long time. Meanwhile, Comrade was willing to re-educate the prisoners. Tim shrugged. Comrade and Hooker kept them organized, and they grew their own crops, and if they escaped, nobody cared. Further to his left, distant in the south, he saw the rising plumes of steam from the nuclear power plant. Closer, the work crews stringing power lines. In another 2 weeks, they would have electricity in the stronghold. Tim tried to imagine what that new life would be like, but it was difficult. The winter had been hard. Damned hard. Eileen's baby had almost died and was still in the hospital. The infant mortality rate was above 50%, but it was slowly falling now, and Forrester's notes showed that when they recovered his books from Tohunga, they would know how to make penicillin. Forrester's notes. That was Tim's job, to transcribe the reels and reels of tape Dan Forrester had dictated before he died. They could have made insulin, maybe, if they hadn't committed themselves to saving the power plant, and of course Forrester had known that. The winter had cost them the life of their magician, as it had so many other lives. To learn that a friend had survived, that was always good. Tim patted his pocket. The past could hit you across the back of the head, no warning. Whap! Tim Hamner patted the telegram in his pocket. Half of a comet. Kitt's Peak had confirmed his sighting. He shook his head violently and laughed at himself. It was only the rain-wrinkled scrap of paper Harry the mailman had brought yesterday. An IOU for $250,000. Harry Stimms was alive. Now what would he take for that IOU? A job at the power plant? Stimms must have mechanical skills, and the power plant boys owed Tim. Failing that, could he promote a pregnant cow? That'd be worth $250,000, easy. Tim gazed into the sky, enjoying himself. A clear, thin line crossed the sky, the tip of it moving forward even as he watched. For a second, he still did not know what it was.
Shout a warning.
But what did we used to call that?
Contrail! Jet plane!
They'd heard something from Colorado Springs, that some of the aircraft had survived. Harvey and Maureen would have to come to terms with Colorado Springs when they got back from visiting a septic tank in Tohunga. But though they'd heard it on the radio, it was not the same as seeing that clean white line across the sky. He'd forgotten how beautiful that could be. Tim waved solemnly at the plane.
"You can fly," he said. His voice rose. "You can fly, but we control the lightning."
The asteroid was a child of the maelstrom, a rough nugget of nickel iron with some stony strata, 3 miles along its long axis. No man had ever seen a mastodon when the passing of mighty Jupiter plucked the nugget from its orbit and flung it out toward interstellar space. It was on the second lap of its long, narrow, elliptical orbit. The iron surface was frosted with strange ices now, as it passed the peak of the curve and began to coast back toward the sun. And the black giant was there. Its ring of cometary snowballs glowed broad and beautiful in starlight. Infrared light traced bands and whorls in its stormy surface. It was the only major mass out here between the stars, and the asteroid curved toward it and increased speed. Infrared light bathed and thawed the frosted iron. The ringed planet grew huge. The asteroid plunged through the plane of the ring at 12 miles per second. Battered and pocked with glowing craters, it receded, carrying in its own small gravitational field a spray of icy masses from the ring. They came like attendants, ahead and behind, in a pattern like the curved arms of a spiral galaxy. The asteroid and a score of comets pulled free of the black giant and began their long fall into the maelstrom.
This has been an Audible Frontiers production. Executive Producer, Steve Feldberg. Producer, Mike Jarzik. Production Coordinator, Kat Lambrix. Directed and engineered by Ian Hackney. Edited by Ray Collins. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 1977 by Larry Niven and Jerry Pournelle. Audio recording copyright 2009 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.